I'm looking with Jodie Rowley at a most beautiful small pink frog. In fact, it's a picture because it comes from Southeast Asia, but it's got lovely big eyes and really the pink hue and those lovely tiny, almost like scales or prickles. What is it?
It's a thorny tree frog, Chrysixylus lumarius, and it was just named a couple of weeks ago. It was discovered by my colleagues and I in the tallest mountains in central Vietnam.
The Science Show, with some new frogs, new to us anyway. In a minute or two, a PhD like no other. She graduated last week at 93, the oldest in Australian history, and still bouncing like a 20-year-old. And you'll meet two of the top figures in world science, Dr. Margaret Leinen of Scripps and Dr. Marcia McNutt of the journal Science. Now back to Jodie Rowley from the Australian Museum and that pink frog. Is it very small?
No, not for a frog. About 4 centimetres in body length. As you said, pink and yellow, which are quite unusual colours for a frog. And males are covered in spikes made out of keratin, so the same kind of things as your fingernails or rhino horn, so give it a sort of a sandpaper appearance.
And what are they for, do you think?
We're not sure, but the fact that the males have the spines and they seem to be more pronounced, much bigger in the breeding season, we think that it might be to do with recognition. So females come along, they feel the back of their potential partner. If it's spiky enough, then it's a male and maybe they'll mate. So they're breeding tree holes in the forest, and so maybe they can't see that much when they're in the tree holes.
Now, you had another discovery of a small brown frog, rather less charismatic. What was that one?
That's Leptilalax botsfordi, which was found on the top of the highest mountain in Vietnam. So the first one, the thorny tree frog, is the highest mountain in central Vietnam, whereas Botsford leaf-litter frog was found on the tallest mountain in Indochina as well, in Vietnam, which is actually a bit of a tourist trail with people trying to climb it. So usually I'm in very remote places, but this small little brown frog that sounds like an insect was just chirping away not far from these huts in the mud on top of a mountain.
So there was enough wetness so that it could live there comfortably and not too cold?
For frogs, I guess it wasn't too cold. For me, it felt like an Antarctic base station. You know, the campsite was at 2,800 metres and it was just this one little stream and there was a bunch of really cool frogs. I spent about an hour, and it was about 11 degrees Celsius, on my hands and knees in the mud, in the fog, looking for this tiny thing. You think you're going crazy after a while. Maybe this is an insect. You know, I do study frogs and I think this is a frog, but maybe I've just lost it. And, you know, shaking and wet, an hour later I finally found one of them. And then we found a few more and they look like a normal leaf-litter frog for most people, but I could tell that they were something special because they were much fatter, especially males had huge arms and lots of fat, probably in order to survive the winter where it actually snows in these mountains.
I'm most impressed because usually when I try to creep up on a frog, any frog, I mean, they just disappear. They just run away. But you persist and somehow you track them down.
Usually they don't run away. Usually they just sit there. But because they look like exactly whatever they're sitting on, you don't see them. So it just takes persistence, which I have some.
But you keep finding these. Is there no limit to the number of frogs, different species that may be hidden in Southeast Asia?
Well, at the moment, species discovery is still pretty exponential in terms of amphibians in Southeast Asia. So there's the really obvious ones, like the pink and yellow spiky frog, which was like, wow, this thing, I've never seen anything like it. I don't even know what genus this thing is in. And then there's the small brown frogs that maybe people have sort of known about, but they just assume that it's the same small brown frog that occurs everywhere else. And it's only when we look at things like DNA and call analysis and really start measuring fine details like the length of the different toes and the distance between the nostrils of the frog that we realise, hey, you know, they're small and brown because that works when you live in the leaf litter. But they are actually really distinct species. And so the discovery is a combination of going to new places, just being lucky and finding things that don't come down the trees often, and some really detailed collaborative work looking at a whole bunch of aspects of the frogs.
Well, just a detail of what is actually published in the journal Science, and I'm going to interview the editor-in-chief of the journal Science in a minute on this program, Dr. Marcia McNutt. Now, this article talks about the selection of, well, when you come across a new species, do you take a sample? Do you actually kill the creature and take it home so that you can do this detailed examination? Or do you worry about the fact that it might be very, very rare and just take a picture, maybe a few measurements at a distance, and leave it at that? Some people were shocked at the suggestion in the journal Science that you should just leave it there. What do you think?
Well, I think that article starts with the premise that if you rediscover a species that you thought was extinct, so you've got a pretty good idea that it's very, very rare, then perhaps you don't need to take a voucher specimen, which is often needed to prove that something's one species or the other. And I think in those instances, particularly if you know what species it is, there's already specimens in the museums, then there potentially is no reason. If you've got a DNA sample that you can compare, you can just take a swab, take some photos, and that's probably enough evidence. In the places that I work and in a lot of places around the world, it's really quite impossible to identify what things are. People send me photographs of frogs and I can't distinguish between 30 species of small brown frogs from a photograph. So when discovering new species, we do take voucher specimens, we take hundreds of photographs of them in the field, take DNA, and we preserve them for eternity. And they become basically the library books of natural history museums. And they're lent around the world, they're studied many, many times, and forever those specimens are that species, they're the type. So they're really important. So I think it just depends where you work. I mean, in Central America, I know colleagues that have worked for 10 years doing ecology, and they missed 11 species of frog that they only discovered later using DNA. So they worked for 10 years at a site, taking photos, you know, handling the frogs, and there was 10 species that were undescribed right under their nose, but they're just so tricky to identify.
So you still have to take specimens. Well, we've talked before about this bonanza of discovery in Southeast Asia, and yet the area is being overwhelmed by human development. Do you think that will eventually wipe out the region?
I think you'll still get some species definitely around that are quite tolerant of human disturbance, but a lot of these frogs are really adapted to specific environments. You know, they'll build nests in the forest floor and the leaf litter, and as soon as you chop too many trees down, then it's not as humid on the ground anymore and they can't breed. Very sensitive to water quality and things like that. So in a lot of places, unless the forest is well protected and enforced, last year I did a couple of surveys in non-protected areas, and I was very upset to think that where we were surveying, we were basically probably recording data on frogs that wouldn't be in the same place in 5 or 10 years.
So you better keep up the work.
Working on it, definitely.
Thank you very much again.
Thank you.
Dr. Jodie Rowley is coordinator of the Australian Museum Research Institute in Sydney, and those extinctions put together have been called a possible sixth extinction, following the five others we've seen over the past 440 million years. Elizabeth Culbert has written a book about our present plight.
I think that we can see what links this current extinction event to the past extinction events is a very dramatic change going on at a rate that many species can't adapt quickly enough to. And that is unfortunately what's going on and why we are in danger of precipitating another very, very serious extinction event, because we are changing the world, and ocean acidification is a very good example of that. You know, reefs have gone out in the past. There have been moments in time when there have been no reef-building organisms. And those are associated with some of the worst crises in the history of life. So that is not something to take lightly at all. That's something to take very, very seriously.
What are the scientists saying? I mean, for example, is there agreement that a mass extinction event is occurring, but the only dispute is whether humans are causing it, or is it more like climate change, where 97% agree that there is a human fingerprint?
I think certainly there's no question that there's a human fingerprint in very, very elevated extinction rates that we have right now. I don't think there's any scientist who would dispute that at all. It's very, very hard to find an organism that's threatened or has gone extinct where you can't point to the human influences that led to that, or at least contributed to it. But I think the only dispute would be, well, these mass extinctions of the past have wiped out 3/4 of the species on Earth. I mean, that's sort of the threshold for these events. Clearly, we have not yet wiped out 3/4 of the species on Earth. So the only question I think that people would raise is, well, has this yet risen to the level where we can say we're in a mass extinction, or should we just say we have very elevated extinction rates, and if they keep up, we will be in a mass extinction? So that's a somewhat more subtle point, but I really don't think there's anyone out there who would argue that humans have not brought about a very, very high level of extinction, way, way higher than at any point in the last, since the dinosaurs went out, really.
Staff writer from The New Yorker magazine, Elizabeth Culbert, with Greg Borschmann from RN Breakfast. More on her book, The Sixth Extinction, next week in The Science Show on RN.